Good evening, I'm Jeff Bennett. Amna Nawaz is away. On the News Hour tonight, a federal judge sets a date for the classified documents case against former President Trump in the thick of the 2024 election season. Our reporter on the ground in Ukraine uncovers evidence that American companies are still supplying parts used in Russia's war effort, despite strict sanctions. And efforts to monitor sharks in the Northeast are ramped up after a recent wave of encounters.
There's new species from down south that typically didn't range as far as New York, but now because of climate change, they're moving into the area.
Good evening and welcome to the News Hour. A federal judge today ordered that the trial in the classified documents case against former President Donald Trump begin on May 20th, 2024. U.S. District Judge Aileen Cannon rejected the Justice Department's bid to try the case in December, as well as the former president's request for a delay until after the 2024 election. The trial in Florida is one of many legal obligations Mr. Trump faces going into the 2024 election cycle, including federal and state criminal probes related to efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Let's turn now to former federal prosecutor Jessica Roth, also a professor of law at Cardozo School of Law. Thank you for being with us. And what's your assessment of this May 2024 trial date? Which side does this scheduling benefit, assuming it holds?
Well, nobody got exactly what they wanted. Former President Trump wanted the trial postponed indefinitely, and so it was a defeat for him in that regard. But the Department of Justice didn't get what it wanted exactly either. They wanted to try this case in December. I think that the May 2024 date is reasonable. I think that it is consistent with other similar cases. And I think, just as importantly, the reasoning that the judge explained in her order setting the new schedule was legally sound, given the extent of the discovery and the legal issues that will have to be litigated with respect to the use of classified information. And I say that because I think it's important in the context of this case. This judge issued rulings previously in related matters after the search of Mar-a-Lago, before the charges were filed, that were not legally sound, that were promptly reversed by the appellate court, and that strongly suggested that she was showing preferential treatment to former President Trump. And so I think the fact that the ruling was legally sound, in my opinion, is significant. The real next test, however, will be whether the judge holds the defense, in particular, to the schedule that she has now set, or whether she will let it slip further.
Looking at the schedule, this May date falls pretty far into the 2024 election season. The vast majority of state primaries will be finished by that point. There will likely be a presumptive Republican nominee by that point, and it could very well be Donald Trump. How, if at all, could that affect this case?
Well, the judge reserved judgment on whether she would at some future point take into consideration the status of former President Trump as potentially a future nominee in further scheduling considerations for the trial. She said she didn't have to address that now for purposes of setting the schedule going forward. But she left open the door such that perhaps if he is seeming to be the likely nominee at that point, his lawyers could raise the issue of whether or not the election, the campaign schedule made it a hardship for him to actually have the trial as scheduled in May, or would make it hard to seat an unbiased jury. So it remains to be seen whether or not she would entertain those arguments for a further postponement at that point. But it's important to note that if the trial were to slip past the general election, there's a very real prospect that it wouldn't happen at all, because if former President Trump became president again, he would likely direct his attorney general to drop the prosecution. And so there's really a lot at stake for when this trial happens. If it's postponed beyond any election, the voters won't have information about whether or not he has been convicted of these very serious charges, which include willful retention of national defense information and obstruction of justice, when they cast their vote, if that matters to them. But then also, it may impact whether or not he is actually held accountable in a court of law for this conduct at all.
Jessica Roth, thanks so much for your insights. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
In In the day's other headlines, there's still no relief in sight from extreme weather that's plagued much of the nation this month. Northeastern Ohio was cleaning up today from intense thunderstorms that hit last night. Winds gusting to 80 miles an hour blew down trees and power lines. That came as blistering heat kept much of the U.S. and Europe on broil. Experts warn heat waves will soon dominate at least half the year.
We're on trend and seeing a rise in global temperatures. So that will contribute to heat waves increasing in intensity and frequency. And what also happens is they spread across the seasons in time. We've got quite clear indications that they're already growing out into spring. It's the area which we are seeing the strongest growth in heat waves.
The UN agency says current extreme heat is likely to persist in much of the world through August. Russian forces kept Ukraine's Odessa region under heavy bombardment today. Cruise missiles took out farm storage buildings and pounded grain terminals. On the Black Sea, the Russian Navy practiced firing drills to blockade any Ukrainian grain shipments. Moscow withdrew this week from a UN deal allowing the shipments. Meantime, Russia's foreign ministry said it's ready to consider ways to restore the grain deal in cooperation with Turkey.
The format that you propose, a new deal with Turkey, is probably possible, but only after our demands are met. If they are met, we're ready to consider any options. We're ready to consider any variations of a deal that would continue grain supplies to world markets, both grains and fertilizers.
In New York today, the UN's humanitarian aid chief warned that blockading grain exports from Ukraine means millions of people in developing countries will go hungry. Back in this country, lawmakers in Alabama have refused to create a second majority black congressional district. That move defies an order from the U.S. Supreme Court to redraw their congressional map to give black voters more of a say in elections. The state's new voting map will likely face a new round of legal challenges. Several major tech companies have agreed to abide by new artificial intelligence safeguards. President Biden met with executives of Amazon, Google, Meta, and others today on the new standards. They include watermarking manipulated content, among other things. For now, the safeguards are voluntary. And stocks were mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 2 points to close at 35,228. The NASDAQ fell 30 points. The S&P 500 added a point. And soccer great Lionel Messi will make his American debut tonight with his new team Inter Miami of Major League Soccer. They'll face off against Mexico City's Cruz Azul in a tournament. Messi had his first training season with his new teammates on Tuesday. The World Cup champion for Argentina has a contract that will pay him more than $1 million per match. And still to come on the NewsHour, an investigation finds sexual assault claims against immigration officials are routinely ignored. Jonathan Capehart and Gary Abernathy weigh in on the week's political headlines. Director Christopher Nolan discusses his new film about the father of the atomic bomb. And we remember the life and legendary career of singer Tony Bennett.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Again today, Ukraine suffered a barrage of Russian missile strikes, part of a deadly summer of attacks. But as NewsHour special correspondent Simon Ostrovsky has discovered, many of the Russian-made cruise missiles wouldn't be able to find their targets without the help of American companies. His investigation is supported by the Pulitzer Center.
In a village about 25 miles north of the western Ukrainian city of Khmelnytsky, Ukrainian military officers show us the remains of a recent Russian missile strike against their country. It's a scene that's become all too familiar in over 500 days of Russia's full-scale war. This guided KH-101 missile didn't hurt anyone. It was shot down by one of the Western air defense systems donated to Ukraine in recent months. These officers' job is to collect the fragments and bring them back to the capital for analysis. They've granted NewsHour unprecedented access to film their work so we can find out for ourselves where the components that help these missiles find their targets come from.
So this looks like it might be part of the flight control unit. This will be really interesting to get a closer look at once it's brought back to the laboratory and cleaned up a little bit, because it's motherboards like these that we often find Western-made microchips in.
This is Irina Nikitska. She runs a hospital lab on the other side of Ukraine, in President Volodymyr Zelensky's hometown of Kryvyi Rih. Last month, she lost the thing most dear to her in a Russian missile strike.
I had an only daughter. She lived. I raised her. I educated her. They took away my meaning of life.
On June 12th, a barrage of missiles, including KH-101s, rained down on the city, hitting this apartment building, where Irina's daughter Ksenia Eppelman and her daughter's husband, David Eppelman, slept.
When the neighbors were escaping, everyone knocked on the door of their apartment, but the door was jammed, and they could hear Ksenia screaming, "David, David," and then they heard nothing, and that was it.
A total of 13 people were killed in the attack.
As a mother, I blame myself. A mother's mission is to keep her safe. Why didn't I feel in my heart that there was danger?
You can't blame yourself.
Russia's ability to fire long-range missiles at Ukraine has brought the terror of war to cities far from fighting, regularly triggering air raid sirens that shake the calm of otherwise peaceful cities. One of the most commonly used is the airplane-launched KH-101, designed originally by Russian aerospace firm MKB Raduga to carry tactical nukes, but now fitted with a conventional warhead and an upgraded guidance system. When Russia fires the KH-101s at densely populated cities like Kryvyi Rih, it may be committing a war crime. But does blame for such attacks end there? Ukrainian officials increasingly believe the companies whose components are being found in numerous Russian missiles need to be held to account too.
This is the factory identifier. The 315 is characteristic of KH-101s.
We're at a secret location in Kyiv where technicians analyze weapons recovered from the battlefield. The fragments from the KH-101 that crashed in Khmelnytsky have been brought here. They've cut the flight control unit out of this section, and we're going to take a look at what they found inside.
If you look at the outer casing of the flight control unit from this KH-101 missile, then you see Russian writing and Russian parts all over it. It looks like a Russian computer. But once you open it up and start looking at the motherboards that are hidden inside, put it underneath the electronic microscope, then you start to see what the brains of this machine are actually made of. And it's full of American components.
If we look here, we see imported components and not a single domestically made one. This is Altera. This is analog devices. Texas Instruments.
In this instrument alone, we found products made by five American companies, the most recently manufactured of which is this Xilinx Spartan 6 microchip made by Santa Clara, California-based AMD in 2020. The company told NewsHour it had no record of the sale of the chip and suspected the markings on it may have been altered. Microchips manufactured after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine started have also turned up in KH-101s, like these Zilog processors, made in March of 2022 and recovered from a missile shot down in the city of Dnipro in March of 2023.
Russia lost the microelectronics war, and this is how it's trying to get by. It may be getting these microchips through contraband. It might be tapping stockpiles it already has. But think about it. All of the mathematics of this missile are in one computer, and without one little microchip, they couldn't assemble it.
It's clear that they have been able to assemble it, even though sanctions have been in place against the Russian arms industry for almost a decade. I asked Alexandra Vasilenko, the Director General for Economic Diplomacy and Sanctions Policy at Ukraine's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, what the U.S. and its allies were doing wrong.
They're really cautious with their dialogue, and they're really cautious with enforcement. And business should be explained what will be the punishment if they will circumvent or not comply with the sanctions. And definitely we see the lack of this conversation.
James Byrne, a director at the Royal United Services Institute in London, and one of the authors of a report on the Russian defense industry's reliance on imported semiconductors, echoed the Ukrainian view that there was little obvious enforcement of Russia sanctions.
I don't believe there has been any such action. We did have huge fines on some of the large financial institutions, and they were ultimately for essentially practices failures in due diligence. So it's certainly a possibility that, something like this could happen, particularly if it's if it continues or if it emerges that some companies really didn't follow any sort of due diligence.
According to Russian state procurement records obtained by NewsHour, the KH-101's onboard computer is made by Russian computer maker Korund M at a cost of around $9,000 each.
Korund M. Надежность в любых условиях.
Moscow's Central Research Institute of Automation and Hydraulics purchased 20 of the units in 2019.
The Central Research Institute of Automation and Hydraulics is a leading company in Russia in the field of air and ground-launched cruise missile manufacturing.
We sent pictures of the microchips we found to their American manufacturers to ask them who they were sold to in order to try to expose Korund M's supply chain. But none of the companies were willing or able to provide the information.
At Texas Instruments, we're much more than one of the world's leading semiconductor providers.
This isn't entirely surprising. American technology giant Texas Instruments, whose components are turning up in multiple weapons platforms used by Russia, including the missile we saw, voted down a proposal to report internally on misuse of their company's products at its annual shareholders meeting in April.
The board of directors recommends a vote against this proposal.
That's Texas Instruments Chairman Rich Templeton. His board of directors recommended to vote against the proposal because of a belief that the company already had a sufficiently robust compliance system in place and, quote, complete traceability and prevention of product misuse is unachievable.
Not only do they not know where their parts are going, it sounds like they don't want to know.
Building compliance teams, tracing supply chains can increase the costs and the burden on some of these manufacturers. But I think, you know, that really is something that a lot of manufacturers and companies should look very closely at, because these components are still ending up in Russian weapons platforms.
Texas Instruments told NewsHour it complies with the law and doesn't support or condone the use of its products and, quote, applications for which they weren't designed. In the meantime, Irina consoles herself with the thought that accountability will eventually come to the people who made the missile that killed her daughter.
The people who do this, they must understand that innocent people are killed by the missiles they make. No, I'm not filled with hate. I just believe that people who bring evil will get what they deserve.
Not everyone in Ukraine is as patient as Irina. Demands for companies to take more responsibility and the U.S. authorities to go after those that don't are only going to grow louder as the civilian death toll grows bigger. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Simon Ostrovsky in Kryvyi Rih, Ukraine.
Immensely Invisible, a new investigation by the Pulitzer Prize-winning organization Futuro Investigates and Latino USA shines a light on allegations of sexual abuse and assaults filed by migrants in U.S. immigration detention facilities. NewsHour producer Zeba Varsi teamed up with Futuro Investigates and has been reporting on this story since 2021. We spoke earlier this week. Zeba, it's good to see you.
It's good to see you, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
So tell us about this investigation into allegations of sexual abuse filed by migrants in immigration detention facilities. What did you find?
What struck me the most was the spirit of three women of color, immigrants who are held in detention centers, and how they came forward to speak about the abuse that they faced. They spoke about sexual voyeurism, open showers. They also talked about how they were assaulted by a medical professional while they were held in one of these facilities. Here's an excerpt of what they've told me.
The county, you never had to worry about voyeurism or none of that. You never had to worry about sharing no shower and none of that. And then I came to Glades and I was like, what?
We used to see the shadow went of like their head. Like you could see it was a male.
And how often did this happen?
Like every day. They never fixed the issue.
He tells me to lower my pants, and he placed the stethoscope there. He was saying, like, good, good, and he was doing, like, strange gestures, like, dirty. He was smiling and looking at me. I was quiet the whole time. For a moment, I was staring off into space and thinking, my God, what is happening?
When I was looking at myself in the mirror and battling with myself, I was thinking, I don't deserve to wear these clothes, and I don't deserve to wear this makeup, because I don't matter, and I felt immensely invisible.
So Zeba, what facilities in particular emerged as the problems in your investigation?
The last two women you just heard were held at Stewart County Detention Center in Georgia. These women have alleged that one male nurse, the same male nurse who was supposed to look after them in the medical clinic inside the facility, assaulted them. And these are not the only ones who've made this allegation. There were at least three other women who made similar allegations against the same male nurse. They complained to ICE about it. They complained to Core Civic, which is a private prison company that runs this particular detention facility. It's been a year this month since they filed their public complaint, and they haven't heard anything back yet. The other woman that we heard from was detained at Glades County Detention Facility in Florida. And she experienced sexual voyeurism. She experienced cross-gender viewing. She also experienced harassment by the psychiatrist at that facility, another medical professional. These women in different facilities don't really know each other, but what they've told us is strikingly similar. And beyond these women, at least a dozen immigrants that I've interviewed across the country who have also talked about similar patterns of assault and abuse, complaints of intrusive pat-down searches, complaints of invasive touching of genitals. It also does emerge that this is not a problem which is isolated to one facility or one state.
You teamed up with veteran journalist Maria Hinojosa for this investigation, and she talks about how she's been doing this reporting, looking into this problem for more than a decade.
ICE has found new ways to deal with the challenges of people in detention complaining about sexual abuse. What we were able to uncover is that one of the ways in which they're dealing with this is by transferring people, transferring migrants and refugees from one detention facility to another as a way of addressing or not addressing complaints of sexual abuse and assault in immigrant detention facilities.
So your investigation found that ICE transfers detainees who make these complaints. How does that play out?
Jeff, if you may remember, in 2021, there were headlines that came out of Irvine County Detention Center in Georgia. That is the place where non-consensual reproductive surgeries were conducted. That facility had to be shut down after nationwide outrage, congressional hearings. But what happened to the women who were detained there? They were not released. Most of them were transferred from Irvine to Stewart County Detention Center. Now, that is the facility in Georgia where Viviana and Mari, the two women, we've changed their names, those two women faced alleged assault by that nurse. Similarly, in the Florida case that we highlight, we had a woman called Marlissa who was detained at Glades County Detention Center. She filed complaints, other women filed complaints. There were many other complaints of abuse, apart from sexual abuse, that were also raised. ICE had to shut down that facility. Women were transferred from Glades to Baker County Detention Center. And at Baker, which is the second facility, Marlissa faced similar, if not worse. Whenever immigrants end up complaining, immigration rights activists say that this has become a consecutive pattern that ICE has adopted of transferring folks from one center to another.
Well, on that point, Zeba, what's the path forward for these women?
Jeff, these women are hoping to hear back on their complaints. We followed up with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, which is the law enforcement agency that took up the case and had promised to conduct a thorough investigation. They said that they've concluded it, the DA's office has it, the DA's office has not released the conclusion yet. We have 300 complaints of sexual assault and abuse that have been filed by immigrants across different centers. 60% of these complaints have no update on whether an investigation was conducted. So the problem that we are highlighting is not only that abuse of immigrants in detention centers is taking place. The fact that it may be happening with impunity, the fact that there is a possible lack of accountability, the fact that most of these cases are not being thoroughly investigated. And that's what we hope to change, and that's what we hope would be the outcome of our story.
Zeba Warsi, thank you so much for sharing that reporting with us.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
And you can read more of Zeba's work and find a link to the full podcast, Immensely Invisible, on our website. That's pbs.org/newshour. After a recent spate of shark encounters, New York State is ramping up efforts to monitor the apex predator off the coast of Long Island. In Massachusetts, experts are raising awareness about the surging population of great white sharks off Cape Cod. Science correspondent Miles O'Brien has the story.
In early July, around 5 o'clock in the evening, off the southern shore of Long Island, New York, 15-year-old Peter Bancooley and his friend Joe went out for an evening surf session at Kismet Beach. The pair were 35 feet from shore when they noticed the water was extra murky.
We were about to catch a wave in, then all of a sudden, like in a blink of an eye, the shark was just there on my foot, like a really, really intense pressure on my foot.
Who helped you out? How did you get to safety?
My foot was pretty much down the shark's, like, throat and its mouth. You know, it was really scary. I'm trying to wiggle my foot out. I'm calling my friend for help. And then eventually we got out, ran up to the beach, got a good Samaritan, and then called the cops from there. I thought my foot was gone. My foot was just all numb. And I didn't really want to look at it because I just knew it was bad.
Peter was one of at least four people bitten by a shark on July 3rd and July 4th off the coast of Long Island. Each occurred on Fire Island beaches, a 32-mile-long barrier island.
It is a concern.
George Gorman is regional director for Long Island State Parks.
Prior to 5 years ago, never would have thought you'd see a shark. Now, I started my career many, many years ago, and there would be a shark report every maybe 2-3 years, but that was it.
Due to a steady increase in shark activity, New York Governor Kathy Hochul increased surveillance across Long Island beaches, providing more watercrafts and drones to be on the lookout for sharks and funding to cover the cost of training.
Given the lessons of last summer and seeing the change in sharks' behavior, we knew early on, before the season even started, we had to take preemptive steps.
As beachgoers flock to the white sand, sharks, too, are swimming off the coasts of New York's most popular beaches. At least one beach delayed opening on July 4th after drones spotted dozens of sand sharks off the coast. With drones to make sharks easier to spot, lifeguards had more time to clear the water after a sighting. Carrie Epstein is a lifeguard supervisor at Jones Beach State Park in Nassau County.
When you're up in an elevated lifeguard station or a lifeguard stand, you could see up and you could see out, but you can't see straight down.
While all this causes alarm, those who study sharks say they are likely making a mistake if they bite.
People are not on the menu. Sharks aren't interested in interacting with people or biting people. We mainly think that this is a result of the shark's natural food, mainly bait fish, generally being closer to beaches where there's a lot of people in the water. It's a very unusual dynamic where the shark food is so close to shore, but it's not unusual at all that there's sharks in New York.
Toby Curtis is a fishery management specialist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He says warming waters are leading sharks to expand their horizons.
Most of the sharks off New York are smaller individuals. Also, what's happening in New York is that there's new species from down south that typically didn't range as far as New York, things like spinner sharks and black-tip sharks. These are species that generally remain south of New York waters, but now because of climate change, they're moving into the area. And likewise, some species are moving further north.
As beachgoers in New York remain on alert, larger great whites are surging off the coast of Cape Cod, swimming in the shallows. To raise awareness of the increased population there, Atlantic White Shark Conservancy developed a Sharktivity app where users can record and log shark sightings and encounters. But why has Cape Cod quickly become one of the largest hotspots for great whites in the world?
Globally, we're losing sharks, we're losing habitat, we're losing these critical creatures in the different ecosystems. In the U.S. waters on the East Coast, we've got a little bit of a different story.
Brian Laguerre is a seascape ecologist for the Center for Coastal Studies. He says there are more great whites in these shallow waters because there are more seals there, one of their favorite meals.
Seals, we almost hunted them to extinction up into the 1960s. And with protection in Massachusetts and then federally in with the Marine Mammal Protection Act, it's taken about 50 years to recover that population.
Sharks are necessary to maintain healthy biodiversity in our oceans, and encounters overall are decreasing. According to the Florida Museum of Natural History's International Shark File, in 2022, the U.S. saw 41 unprovoked shark attacks, one of which was fatal. That's down from 47 attacks in 2021. But if you find yourself face to face with a shark...
Most of the time, sharks, they'll bite a person, they'll realize they've made a mistake, this is not their normal food, you know, they let go and swim off. But if that's not the case, it's best to fight back, hit the shark on the nose or the eyes, those are very sensitive areas.
Peter Bancully's encounter left him with a broken foot, fractured in three places, and a torn Achilles. He hopes to get back on the board in weeks.
I'm curious what mom and dad think about this.
There's waves today, but his foot's in a cast. I would say let's go, you know?
Kelly, how about you? Are you ready to let these two go hang 10?
So I have a very large fear of the water to begin with. So this has deepened my fear. But as a mom, I feel that the best way to overcome his fear is to get back on that board and continue to surf. We live on a beautiful island. We should be able to share the water together.
Something Peter can't wait to do again. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien.
Now to further discuss how investigations into the former president are affecting the 2024 presidential race and more, we turn to the analysis of Capehart and Abernathy. That's Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post, and Gary Abernathy, also a Washington Post contributor. It's great to see you both. So the classified documents case against Donald Trump now has a trial date. As we reported, the federal judge in that case ordered it to start as early as May 20th, 2024. Jonathan, what do you make of this potential scenario where Donald Trump could potentially be the presumptive Republican nominee, and he's also facing a criminal trial? This mid-May date is after most of the primaries, and it's before the nominating conventions.
Right. Well, I baked that in. I thought from the very beginning that there would be no distinction between Donald Trump's campaign appearances and Donald Trump's, you know, going in for his various court appearances for the various trials that he's a part of. And so all I know is this. I am glad that there is a date set, that there is a date set before the general election, assuming he is the Republican nominee for president. But I'm also happy and glad that there is a date set, because no matter what happens to Donald Trump in terms of the 2024 Republican presidential nomination, Donald Trump is now going to be held publicly accountable through a trial for his role, assuming, again, that there is in the documents case, he will be held accountable for withholding, taking classified documents, including nuclear secrets. This is very, very serious, and I'm glad he's going to be held accountable for it.
Gary, Donald Trump faces as many as 6 criminal and civil cases in this election cycle. Doesn't this in some ways incentivize his Republican rivals to stay in this race longer than they might be inclined to or could be, have the support to, because they're waiting for a potential Donald Trump candidacy collapse?
Well, as we've seen so far, every time he's indicted, it just makes him stronger. So if there are 6 indictments, how strong is that going to make him? Because it seems to rally the Republicans around him more and more. And I think his opponents, except for Chris Christie maybe, you know, are not taking the right tack. They're kind of still defending Trump and complaining about these charges at the same time that they're trying to run against Trump. That doesn't make a lot of sense. But, you know, the trial date is an interesting timing. I think that, you know, you're also looking at another indictment possibly on the January 6th issue, which you know, I thought the documents indictment was a mistake, not because he didn't do anything wrong, but because I just think it's going to be bad for the country. And I think there's obviously, I think, going to be an indictment come on his actions on January 6th, which I also think is going to be a mistake. Because,
really? Why?
Well, because here's the thing, Jeff. Is it going to be, I think you don't have to just prove that Donald Trump tried to reverse an election result, but in essence, they've got to prove he tried to basically overthrow a duly elected government. And I think you get into issues of free speech, into just going down a road that I don't think is going to be healthy for the country to have this debate while Donald Trump is probably going to be your nominee, your Republican nominee for president.
Jonathan, I suspect you see this matter differently as we await a potential indictment from the special counsel on Donald Trump's role in January 6th.
Oh, absolutely. I disagree wholeheartedly with Gary. To not hold Donald Trump, to not indict Donald Trump in the classified documents case, or potentially, as we might, as we'll find out next week, in the January 6th investigation of the special counsel, is to not hold him accountable. It is not a mistake to hold the person who was the leader of the country, the occupant of the Oval Office. It is not a mistake to hold him accountable for taking classified documents, and not just one or two. There's a report out there that there are 1,500 pages, some including the most sensitive secrets of this nation, including nuclear secrets. He must be held accountable for that, and I'm glad he was indicted for that. And next week or down the road, we'll find out what Special Counsel Jack Smith is going to do in terms of an indictment of Donald Trump related to January 6th. And if an indictment comes down, it is good for the country because the country needs to hear this. The country needs to see this. And the signal needs to be sent to any Donald Trump wannabes, either in this race or in future generations, that if you try to overthrow or overturn a free and fair election, you will be held accountable. It might not be the next day or months down the road, but you will be held accountable in a court of law by a jury of your peers.
I think, though, Jonathan and Jeff, it also has the effect of perpetuating the cycle of retribution. We see that going on right now in Congress. We see that going on with the Jim Jordan, James Comer weaponization of government investigation. You went after Trump, so we're going to go after Biden. We're going to go after... It just, someone needs to end this. And hopefully, as I've argued, it needs to be the voters that end this. You know, when you can just... What makes Trump stronger all the time is this notion that it plays into his complaint that there's a deep state conspiracy out to get me. And this is just going to perpetuate that and reinforce that idea.
Well, on that point, the former president seems to be getting some backup from his Republican rivals on the trail. Here's how a couple of them, at least, responded to the news that Donald Trump received this target letter from the special counsel related to the January 6th investigation.
I think it was shown how he was in the White House and didn't do anything while things were going on. He should have come out more forcefully, of course that. But to try to criminalize that's a different issue entirely. And I think that we want to be in a situation where, you know, you don't have one side just constantly trying to put the other side in jail.
With regard to the prospect of an indictment, I hope it doesn't come to that. I'm not convinced that the president acting on the bad advice of a group of crank lawyers that came into the White House in the days before January 6th is actually criminal.
Jonathan, taking what the former Vice President Mike Pence had to say, given that he was targeted by Donald Trump and his supporters on January 6th, he, of all of the Republican candidates, would be able to draw the strongest, the biggest contrast on that particular issue, and yet he chooses not to.
Yeah, and he chooses not to, and it's shameful. His life was in danger that day. 535 members of Congress, their lives were in danger that day. The fact that the only person in the Republican race right now is Governor Chris Christie, who is willing to say things as the way they are, just shows how far the Republican Party has fallen. I'm old enough to remember Donald Trump on the campaign trail in 2016 saying it would be a mistake for the American people to vote for someone who's under a federal investigation. Donald Trump now has two criminal indictments, maybe others coming down the road. And yet he's got a party that is circling the wagons around him, including a guy whose own life was threatened by it. It's unbelievably shameful. And one thing about what Gary said about, you know, let's end this cycle of retribution. The retribution started with Donald Trump, and ending the cycle would be surrender. It would be surrender to authoritarian forces trying to take over our democracy.
Well, let me say what Donald Trump did on January 6th, and I've said everything he did after losing that election. To deny losing that election has been bad for this country and bad for democracy. But being bad for democracy, bad for the country, is not the same as being criminal. And I think there's just, it's bad for this country to try to, when you're the Biden DOJ, going after your primary political opponent has a very bad look to it.
We have a couple of minutes left, and I want to raise the trip that the Vice President, Kamala Harris, made to Florida today. It was a last-minute trip, and she was tackling changes to the state's education standards that appear to play down the horrors of slavery. The Florida Board of Education voted this week to approve revised Black History curriculum that includes instruction on how slaves actually benefited from slavery because they learned some skills. I see you shaking your head.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I don't know what the fear is of teaching Black history, of teaching the horrors of slavery, of teaching what a horrible chapter in our history was. There's nothing to be afraid of with that teaching. It's, and you know what? We've downplayed it too much in the past. And it's absolutely, I'm going to agree with Kamala Harris in a rare instance this time on what she's saying. And I've never understood what DeSantis's problem is or anyone else with teaching accurate history about the horrors of slavery in this country.
Jonathan, how do you see it? And tell me more about the vice president's role in tackling cultural issues, to include this, abortion, and so on.
Wow. Well, Gary and I are in 100% alignment on this. why are we afraid to talk about the nuances and complexities of our history, of American history, of Black history? You know, the vice president going down to Florida, going right into the heart of the matter to talk about this is a great thing, because she is uniquely qualified to talk about this as the first Black woman, the first South Asian American to hold the office of vice president. When she speaks about issues of race, when she speaks about issues of culture, when she speaks about issues of choice, she is speaking from the heart. And that is the most genuine she can be, and it is an asset to the Biden-Harris ticket as they go into a presidential election in 24, where those issues are going to be paramount.
Jonathan Capehart and Gary Abernathy. Quite a conversation on this Friday evening. Thank you both. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Robert Oppenheimer was one of this country's greatest scientists, father of the atomic bomb, a victim of the McCarthy witch hunts, one complicated and fascinating man. And he's now the subject of a new film by director Christopher Nolan. Jeffrey Brown spoke to Nolan earlier this week for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Played by actor Cillian Murphy, Robert Oppenheimer comes to very large life in a film that is star-studded and action-packed. But for director Christopher Nolan, it was the internal human conflict at its core that first grabbed him.
It's genuinely the most dramatic story I know of that I've ever encountered, either, you know, fiction or real life. So to me, taking on this person who changed the world irrevocably, I really warmed to the challenge of trying to jump into his head.
I understand you even wrote the script in the first person?
Instead of saying, you know, Oppenheimer comes into the room, sits down at his desk, and says, I came into the room, I sat down at my desk. I felt that that way we'd be on a journey with Oppenheimer's story towards understanding rather than judgment.
Nolan based his drama on American Prometheus, the 2006 Pulitzer Prize-winning biography by Kai Bird and Martin Sherwin, highlighting the ethical choices that played out in the very real time of World War II, with unknowable consequences on the ground and in the atmosphere, here between Oppenheimer and Albert Einstein.
What do you take it to mean?
Neutrons smash into nucleus, releasing neutrons to smash into other nuclei. Criticality,
Point of no return, massive explosive force. But this time, the chain reaction doesn't stop.
It would ignite the atmosphere.
When we detonate an atomic device, we might start a chain reaction that destroys the world.
I wanted to put the audience in the position of scientists asked by their government, by the military, to help in a race against the Nazis, to unleash the power of the atom. And that's where the ethics come in, is in a situation where you truly have no choice, because you can't allow the Nazis to have a nuclear bomb, or be the first to have a nuclear bomb. What then are your responsibilities as a scientist for something that was necessary and consequences that are, whether unintended or not, perhaps inevitable? But in bringing this thing into the world, it raises all kinds of thorny questions about the responsibility of creators for the technology that they unleash on the world.
At 52, the British-born, LA-based Nolan is a powerhouse in his world, with blockbuster hits like Inception and Interstellar that bend time and space. The Dark Knight trilogy that reimagined the Batman superhero classic, and the historical epic Dunkirk. His films have grossed some $5 billion worldwide. In Oppenheimer, he took on new cinematic challenges, foregoing computer-generated imagery, filming all the effects, using newly developed black and white as well as color IMAX film, even in extreme close-ups of characters' faces.
The look and experience you're giving us, are they as important to you as the story, or do they somehow go hand in hand?
Well, to me, they absolutely go hand in hand. Cinema is this fusion of sound, images, music, humanity, shifts in perspective from the subjective to the objective. I like to shoot celluloid film because it's still the closest analogy to the way the eye sees. It's the highest quality imaging format if you're shooting large format film. So even when it came to things like Oppenheimer's visualizations of atoms, the quantum world, and the thread of that that had to run through to its ultimate expression in the atomic bomb itself, I wanted those to be analog. I wanted those to be real things we could photograph.
First atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945, ending the war, though debate has continued whether Japan was already set to surrender. The final death toll, uncertain as well, was at least 200,000. Oppenheimer was left a public hero, a world-famous figure, but one racked with doubts about what he and his colleagues had done. He would argue against the creation of the even more powerful hydrogen bomb, and amid the toxic Cold War brew of the 1950s, see his loyalty challenged, and in a final humiliation, have his security clearance revoked. Nolan is well aware of contemporary resonances, including the advent of AI, a potentially world-changing technology unleashed without an understanding of potential consequences.
Do you worry that history is repeating itself?
I take some comfort in learning that the leading AI researchers literally refer to this moment right now as their Oppenheimer moment. They're looking to his story for some kind of guidance about the role and responsibility of the creator of a piece of technology. But of course, as a filmmaker, not as a documentary maker, and not as a politician, I'm making a dramatic experience for the audience. I'm trying to give them a thrill ride. It's weird to use the word entertainment in relation to a story that's so serious, but entertainment in cinema is about engagement with a story, and my job as a filmmaker is to pull the audience in for this very, very dramatic story. And I think it raises a lot of relevant and troubling questions, but it doesn't provide any easy answers.
Oppenheimer is a huge story. It's a hugely important story. It's a 3-hour film. You're an ambitious storyteller, filmmaker, an ambitious man.
The thing I love about movies, the thing I love about the cinema screen is movies can literally be anything, any kind of story. And certainly, there's always been an understanding in the history of movies that this kind of story can be told on this scale for an audience. am I ambitious to sort of to go ahead and do that? I mean, yes, certainly. But also, you know, history is on my side in terms of there are a lot of great examples of movies that we love that, that are more serious, but do present a different type of entertainment. It's a tricky word, as I say. I prefer to say engagement. But, you know, that's what we're doing. We're telling a very big, very important story, using the tools to put it on the biggest screen possible.
Robert Oppenheimer died in 1967 at age 62. Christopher Nolan is now telling his story in theaters worldwide. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown in New York.
Finally tonight, remembering Tony Bennett, one of the greatest singers of American standards. Bennett died today at the age of 96, following a seven-decade-long career. He recorded more than 70 albums and won 19 Grammys, picking up most of those after he turned 60. After serving as a combat infantryman in World War II, who helped liberate a concentration camp, Tony Bennett came back to New York in 1946 and was signed by Columbia Records in 1950. But it wasn't until the 1960s when he truly broke through as a major star, after becoming known for his signature song, I Left My Heart in San Francisco.
I'm going home to my city by the bay. I left my heart in San Francisco.
In the decades that followed, he devoted much of his career to singing the works of Cole Porter, Duke Ellington, George Gershwin, and others, along with jazz standards, which he often referred to as the Great American Songbook.
I won't dance.
More recently, he was known for his duets with contemporary artists and a long collaboration with Lady Gaga that led to albums and concerts. Tony Bennett was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2016, but he performed even after that. Jeffrey Brown sat down with him back in 2014. He asked him how he got started and about his love for jazz.
My father died when I was 10 years old, and all my relatives, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, they would come over every Sunday, and my brother, my sister, and myself would entertain them. They'd make a circle around us. Mm-hmm. And it was just at a time, being 10 years old, I'm saying, what am I going to do in life? I mean, is anybody ever going to know me or anything like that? And my family would say, we like the way you sing and we like the way you paint those flowers. Mm-hmm. So they created a passion in me of always try to improve. And here I am, 88, and I'm still working at trying to get better and better at what I'm doing.
You still feel that, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you remember that young guy first starting to sing, mm-hmm. and then here you are still singing?
Well, I was blessed under the GI Bill of Rights when I came out of the service in the war. I joined the American Theater Wing, and it was a great choice that they allowed us to continue school that we missed during the war. The main thing that I learned from them was to always stay with quality, never compromise. You know, don't just try and get a hit record. Let's do something that's going to last.
He told me he's especially eager to help keep the jazz music he loves alive, and that too ties into the new work with Lady Gaga.
It's the only great art form that's ever been created in the United States by African Americans in New Orleans. They invented it, mm-hmm. to improvise. Elongated improvisation, mm-hmm. and it's a wonderful art. So that's the reason I did the album with Lady Gaga, to reach that young audience that she has. And for the first time in their life, they hear wonderful songs that swing and last forever. They're great American songs that were done in the 20s and 30s. Yes, I got you.
He was one of a kind. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett. Have a great weekend.